Given the subjects we'll be tackling in the hour ahead, facing adversity, learning from failure, mastering the art of quitting, the Winter Olympics provides irresistible narratives. From the figure skater who falls hard but gets up and finishes his program well, to the champion who feels the pain in his back and knows when it's time to withdraw from competition, there are lessons in the dramas on ice. There's also one in the comments of a great American speed skater who continues to blame a controversy over Under Armour's high-tech racing suit for his poor finishes at Sochi. Conversations with three authors who examine adversity and failure from different perspectives. That's just ahead on Midday after the news from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years. NovoNordisk-US.com.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock, and you're tuned to Midday here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Today's programming is made possible by WYPR members and by Cristo Rey Jesuit High School, a Catholic Jesuit college preparatory school serving Baltimore City youth, now seeking area businesses to participate in its innovative corporate internship program. Information is available from Janet Schock, 410-727-3255. Temperatures in the 40s today, highs in the 50s later this week. This is WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. This winter's Olympic Games at Sochi constitute the biggest events in many athletes' lives. Because the Winter Games only happen every 4 years and place each competition on the world stage, many of these competitors may only have one chance to prove their ability in front of the millions of viewers. For this reason, the highs of success are never higher. And conversely, failure is inevitable for most athletes, as only a few can return home medal in hand. U.S. figure skater Jeremy Abbott took a hard fall during his performance last week, essentially eliminating his chances of having a medal placed around his neck. Nonetheless, instead of quitting skating off the ice, Abbott elegantly finished his program to a rapturous ovation from an audience impressed with his resolve. Failure is inevitable. It's an inevitable part of life for non-athletes, the business person, the artist, the computer programmer, the short order cook. Failing is something we all experience as we navigate our ways through the world. And today on Midday in this hour, we explore the nuances of how experiencing failure, adversity, and other difficulties actually can improve our ability to attain goals and live productively. This hour comes to us in three sections and features three different authors who have written about adversity and failure and the positive role it can play in our lives. We'll hear from best-selling author Dr. Norman Rosenthal, well known as a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School and in private practice here in Maryland. His book, The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks and Imperfections. It's an uplifting account of how adversity can shape our lives for the better. Through anecdotes and his own personal stories, Dr. Rosenthal explores instances of everyday hardships in our lives that produce profound, teachable moments. He'll be with us later on in the show, as will Peg Streep. Peg Streep is an author and a blogger for Psychology Today. She's going to speak to us about her newest book, Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. This book takes a deep and pragmatic look at what she calls quitting artfully. Peg Streep writes that this artful quitting will help us move past the places in life where we may feel stuck and can help us to move past our deep-rooted ideas of persistence that prevent us from setting new goals. Interesting stuff. But we're going to start the hour with Megan McArdle. Megan McArdle, columnist for the Bloomberg View, her new book is The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success, an honest, interesting, and sometimes humorous book, and a look at the failures in our personal lives and society at large and how failing well can lead to progress and even triumph. Megan McArdle writes that in a society that too often shirks away from risk that may result in failure, people should be encouraged to fail early and often so that they can accumulate the experience and knowledge that will be the tools to their success later on. Megan McArdle has written for The Atlantic, The Economist, and Newsweek. She appears regularly on Fox, MSNBC, and NPR, and now, of course, with Bloomberg View. The Upside of Down, Why Failing is the Key to Success, is in hardback through Viking Press, and it's also on Kindle. Megan McArdle, thank you for joining us on Midday.
Thanks for having me.
What got you to this, studying bankruptcies, businesses that go under? What was it that got you to this subject?
Well, that was certainly a part of it, but a big part of it was my own failures and learning that one of the most surprising things that I've learned over the course of this is how many people will say things like getting fired or going to prison or getting cancer or getting left at the altar was the best thing that ever happened to me. And certainly in my own case, that was true. The best thing that ever happened to me was being unemployed for 2 years after I got an MBA from the University of Chicago, because at the end of that road was my decision to become a journalist and 12 great years talking to really smart people, writing down what they say, and telling the world about new ideas and new things that are happening.
So, Megan, it's not just spin when someone says that awful thing was the best thing that ever happened to me.
No, absolutely not. And I don't want to say that that means it wasn't awful. I was really miserable when I was unemployed. It was terrible. I think towards the end of it, I remember going to a happy hour for my business school class, and everyone was getting married and getting new jobs, and then there was me drinking water because I couldn't afford a real drink. And a guy I didn't know very well walked up to me and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "I am perilously close to despair." He sort of sidled away from me. But, you know, a couple weeks after that, I got the job offer from The Atlantic, from The Economist, which was what launched me on my journalistic career. Hmm. And so, you know, I had to get to that point. What I realized in retrospect was that, you know, I had had, when I graduated from business school, a very lucrative job with a management consulting firm that then fell through. They laid off my whole associate class without ever starting us. And, you know, it would have been, I always wanted to be a writer since I was 8. I wanted to be a writer, but I'd always done things that were more secure and felt more sensible. And had I had that six-figure job with my 6 figures of student loan debt, I don't think I would have dared to take the risk and follow that dream of becoming a writer. And boy, I'm glad I did.
It's sort of built into us that failure is bad, and yet failure is fundamental. Failure will happen to everybody at some point. I like the comparison you make between the pain of failure and a blister on a tennis player's hand. You know, that's evidence that you've experienced something and that you're trying hard.
It's not just that, although it is that. And learning to do that, to struggle in the face of adversity, is probably the most important lesson that we learn as a kid. But it's also evidence, right, that your hands are changing and they're getting better for holding, they're better suited for holding a tennis racket because now you've got calluses in the place where it's otherwise likely to rub and chafe. And that's a good metaphor for how failure is for all sorts of things. It does hurt. It can be quite painful in the short term. But if you keep going, what it does is shape us into someone who's capable of meeting a challenge that we weren't capable of doing before.
This chapter, The Virtuous Society, I wanted to focus on that with you a bit because you write so much about business and the economy. This has to do a lot with the risk and failure in financial markets and in industry. And you know, you say we're averse to risk. We're becoming more risk averse.
Oh, we are. I mean, if you look at everything from how kids are in their personal lives, you know, the phenomenon of helicopter parents, which everyone is talking about, parents are hovering over their kids like never before. I'm now hearing people say parents are showing up at job interviews. Parents are showing up at grad school admissions interviews, and I thought that these were jokes or they found the one time this happened in the country, but no, everywhere I go, someone has a story about this happening. Teachers have stories about how their students are changing. But on the other side, we're starting fewer new businesses. We're starting fewer of the new high-growth businesses that are what we depend on for the economic engine of growth. And so we are becoming more risk-averse, in part because, you know, we've had a lot of blows recently, but we need to be resilient about that. We need to pick ourselves up and try again and understand that, you know, the price of growth is that things hurt for a while.
You know, this is an interesting idea that failure helps us figure out what works and what doesn't work. But gee, do you really want to go through that? I mean, most people think, oh, I don't want to take that risk. I can figure out what's not going to work. But, you know, how do you really know? You don't really know.
You never do. And my favorite story about this, which I talk about in the book, is New Coke.
New Coke. I remember New Coke.
Yeah, for those of us who are old enough to remember, I was a kid when it came out, but I remember it. So Pepsi was hot on their heels, so they decided they were going to launch a new product. But they knew they had this iconic brand. It was popular around the world. So they do the most elaborate market research studies ever. They do the biggest market research study, and then after they get the results, they do it again and again. And they're always getting the same result, which is that this is the best product ever. It's amazing. It's going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It lasted months on the market. It nearly took the company down with them. I mean, the thing that they did that was right was that they took feedback. And a lot of times companies who make disastrous mistakes like that don't, and they just double down. Coke pulled it back, and it actually ended up being good for their brand because it reminded people that they loved Coca-Cola. On the other hand, you know, Titanic. James Cameron was convinced before it came out that it was going to be a total flop, and so was everyone else connected with the movie. So, no, you cannot tell in advance whether something's going to succeed or fail. Unfortunately, the only way to do it is to try.
You contrast Cameron's Titanic in the book with Kevin Costner in Waterworld.
It's funny, you know, when you strip off the title and you don't know what the movie is, they sound a lot alike,
yeah.
Right? You've got big sets, and water is super expensive and difficult to work with. You've got big famous people connected with them. It had been a long time dream of both Kevin Costner and James Cameron, and then you have at the end they ran wildly over budget. In fact, Waterworld looked better on paper in a lot of ways. At least it met its release date, and it wasn't over 3 hours long, which is a problem both because people don't like really long movies and because theater owners don't like them, because then you can't show it as many times in a night. And yet, Titanic was the one that came out on top. And you can look back in retrospect and say, oh, well, you know, Titanic has all these great qualities and Waterworld doesn't. But there's a lot of hindsight in that, right? We now know one succeeded and one didn't. And so we describe the things about Titanic that are different from Waterworld. But as sociologist Duncan Watts says, what you're really doing when you do this, you're not describing what makes for a successful movie. You're describing a movie that succeeded.
You talked to people involved in bankruptcy for this book. I think, did you interview some bankruptcy judges?
I did. I interviewed bankruptcy judges, bankruptcy attorneys, people who had gone bankrupt, someone who wanted to go bankrupt and couldn't. And it was really a revelation. I've always been a big supporter of the United States bankruptcy system, which is, most people are not aware of, the most generous bankruptcy system in the world by far. In most places, you just can't go into a judge and say, look, I made a mistake. I need to have my debts cleared, and have the judge say, okay, well, we're wiping out your debts. It's known as Chapter 7 in the United States, and it's unique. It's so unique that an expert I was interviewing on a completely different topic in the middle of the book just started making fun of it. Europeans think it's a little crazy that we do this, but it turns out that the more generous your bankruptcy system is, the more entrepreneurship you have. And in retrospect, you think about that, that does make sense, right? Because first of all, it's a lot easier to take the risk of starting a business if you know you're not going to lose your house. But also, once it's happened, and I interview a Danish entrepreneur who's stuck from business setbacks that he had 10 years ago, second of all, once that's happened, if you are shackled to these old debts and you just can't get shut of them, then you end up, instead of focusing on creating growth and so forth, you try to focus on you're just focused on that debt instead of moving forward and creating something new for the economy. And so overall, this is a really good story. That doesn't mean, again, bankruptcy is still unpleasant for the people who go through it. But it actually turns out it's a great way, and one of the stories I profile is Dave Ramsey, enormously successful personal finance person, declared bankruptcy when he was a young real estate investor, eventually paid all the money back, but it gave him that breathing room that he needed in order to get himself back together. And it also gave him this kind of come-to-Jesus moment. He's evangelical, this moment where he said, I'm never doing that again. How do I get out of it? And then he started telling other people how to not have that happen to them. And now he's one of the most successful radio hosts in the country and probably in the world, just telling this message every day to stay out of debt and how to clean up your finances.
That gets me to the last thing I wanted to ask you about today, and that is forgiveness. I would say we have a forgiving bankruptcy system. But some folks may wonder, what does forgiveness have to do with this idea of learning from failure? So a little bit on that, Megan.
Well, I mean, bankruptcy is the perfect example of this. Once something has happened, once something has gone wrong, you have to say, okay, well, that happened. We can't undo it. How do we move forward in the best way? And we're very good at that with businesses. Americans are great at this with business. We're great at taking executives who've been in a failed enterprise and just really, you know, rehiring them, relaunching them into new careers. On the other hand, we're really bad at doing this with people who've committed crimes. Our prison system is really terrible, the number of people we incarcerate, but also how devastating it is when those people get out and are basically unemployable. It turns out forgiveness is a lot cheaper than we think. And so one of the chapters, I profile an innovative probation system in Hawaii. Not, you know, this is not about not punishing people or forgetting what they did. I mean, this, when you fail, that's valuable information. We don't want to forget about it. But it's focused on restoring people to society instead of just punishing them for what they did wrong. And so what they do, ironically, they actually punish them more frequently. It's very small punishments, a couple of nights in jail if you, say, have a dirty drug test, and a lot of focus on treatment and helping people to become the kind of routine, normal, bourgeois, middle-class people that they weren't often raised as. I mean, they usually come out of chaotic homes with a lot of trouble and so forth. And this is really important because it turns out that it's not just better for the criminals. It's cheaper. It saves the state of Hawaii a huge amount of money on prison time. And we know from other studies of things like juvenile justice that when you give people really tough crime sentences, what you're actually doing is encouraging them in criminality, because what do? They lose, they don't have any skills, right? They've big gap in their resume. And who are they in prison with? Other criminals who teach them how to be better criminals.
A comment from one of our listeners by email, back to the original point we started off with here today. Kevin in Hagerstown, Maryland says, when someone says adversity builds character, I tell them that adversity reveals character. How we respond to a situation is who we are. Megan McArdle, thank you for spending a little bit of time with us. Megan McArdle, columnist with Bloomberg View, talking about her new book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. It's published by Viking. Thank you, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
We have to take our first break in this hour of midday, but when we return, Peg Streep joins us, co-author of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. She'll be joining us in just a moment.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Coming our way later today,
Chicago's old commuter trains.
It's fundamentally important to have a thriving business community to have good public transit. So it's short-sighted not to spend money on that.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Finding money to upgrade Chicago's transit. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Catch Marketplace at 6:30 this evening here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Then stay tuned tonight at 7 for PRI's The World. And coming our way tomorrow,
I'm Sheila Cast. On Maryland Morning, Wednesday at 9, doctors are dealing with drug shortages. We talk about possible solutions and why the reply all email function can be a dangerous thing. Maryland Morning, Wednesday at 9, here on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Programming on WYPR is made possible by WYPR members and by the University of Maryland Children's Hospital, where 150 pediatric specialists and 23 specialties help newborns to young adults live healthy lives. To learn how they can help, umm.edu/children. Temperatures in the 40s today, lows around 30 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, highs could hit 50. Temperatures in the upper 50s or maybe even around 60 later this week. This is WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, now joined by Peg Streep, contributor to Psychology Today and the author of several books about psychology. Her previous work has focused on women's issues in psychology, including the book Mean Mothers, Overcoming the Legacy of Hurt. She joins us now to discuss her newest book, co-authored. It's called Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. It's from DeCapo Press, co-authored with Alan Bernstein. Peg Streep, thank you for joining us on Midday.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I want to go right to the word persistence. I love this, what you have to say about the psychology of persistence. Persistence is considered a virtue. Quitting is considered a bad thing, generally. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. Every single adage that we have, winners never quit and quitters never win, and every, come-from-behind story, whether it's Rocky the Fighter or about a racehorse, Seabiscuit, we love those stories. We love the come-from-behind story. We love the person who keeps going. And in fact, my own suspicion is that our favorite stories actually are those where persistence overcomes moments of failure. In other words, it's my humble opinion that if Edison had invented the light bulb on the first try, it wouldn't have been so interesting. It's the idea that, people keep plugging away. And we also love the idea of persistence because it's so democratic.
Yeah,
and all I have to do is keep trying,
have to keep
and I'll
trying.
Get there.
Yeah, absolutely. But is it also associated with the fear of failure?
Well, it's not so much the fear of failure, I don't think, as it is, and it's true enough, the kind of quitting I talk about in the book isn't the kind of quitting that, of course, we all don't like. And that's the act of someone who, for numerous or a single reason, can never finish anything. Quits too early, is a slacker. We've all known those people. We've worked with those people. Even fifth graders who are giving a group report have had the experience of the one person who somehow doesn't pull his or her weight.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kinds of quitters that we think of when we hear the word quit.
There's also some of us who quit in a huff, quit as an emotional reaction to a bad situation.
Well, actually, the whole huff and puff, I'm out of here moment was one of the things that came to mind when the idea for this book came up. And that is, first of all, why is it that people who quit emotionally often end up stuck with all of those feelings and thoughts, even though technically speaking, they've actually left? A homey example of that is someone who's been through a bad breakup in a relationship or in a marriage goes out on a first date, and what does he or she talk about? His or her ex.
Right.
So I started to look into what distinguished good quitting from bad quitting and discovered, in fact, that there was a very large and varied body of research that has examined quitting. The technical word for it is goal disengagement. And I discovered, in fact, that goal disengagement isn't the I'm out of here moment. It isn't the straw that broke the camel's back and the slamming of the door, which leaves you with a tremendous amount of baggage, emotional and cognitive baggage usually. But that goal disengagement is really a process. And it's a process that involves thoughts, emotions, behaviors, and motivations. And while it begins with leaving something, it ends with pursuing a new goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's really different from what we think about as quitting.
And then I'll circle back to the word persistence again, because that seems so deep-rooted in this, that it's hard to, if you want to get to goal disengagement, dislodge yourself from this persistence, this idea that I've got to keep trying because I can't fail and I can't just quit.
Well, look, persistence is a very good thing. Don't get me wrong. However, it is not, as the cultural stance would have us think, a standalone. It's got to be combined with the ability to quit or disengage. Because if you cannot disengage, you are very, very likely actually to overstay in many different endeavors, whether it's a work or a relationship, because there has to be a moment of realism where you ask yourself, wait, are my persistent efforts ultimately going to yield achieving what I want to achieve? And most of us at one point or another in our lives will answer that question, and the answer is going to be no.
But how many?
So the ability to move on is really, really important.
But Peg, how many people even take the time in their busy lives and trying to keep a job, maintain a job, maintain income, maintain a lifestyle, to even thinking about, am I achieving what I want to achieve? First, you have to take stock. You have to set goals. You have to figure out what your goals are.
Well, that's right. And most people, by the way, begin to do that when they become actively unhappy. I mean, that's really the truth.
Mm-hmm.
When things are going along swimmingly, there's really no need to think about leaving, is there?
No.
It's that moment at which you realize that it's not just that you're not happy, but you're actively unhappy or you're actively dissatisfied, that people begin to think about the possibility of quitting and leaving. And really, the reason for this book is that when that moment, if that moment does come, when the tipping point of your unhappiness or dissatisfaction has taken place, many people will find it very, very difficult to leave. And that's because human beings are hardwired to persist. We're kind of preaching to the choir when we tell people to keep going. Thanks to evolution, we're hardwired to keep going.
Peg Streep is our guest, co-author of Mastering the Art of Quitting, Why It Matters in Life, Love, and Work. So your advice is, and folks can read the book to get the full extent of your advice, but you have to learn to quit and quit well, and you have to have a plan.
Well, that's right. And you have to recognize that in many ways your habits of mind are probably colluding against you, so that you need to be able to learn not only to manage your thought processes about quitting, but also manage the emotions that inevitably come with making a change. Human beings are very, very conservative. I mean, we like to think of ourselves, particularly when, you know, you're watching the Olympics and you go, wow, look at all these risk takers. The reality of it is that as the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, they won the Nobel Prize for it, actually showed, people are much more loss-averse than they are motivated by a possible gain. So when we think about leaving something or someone, we think about the investment we've made, the time, energy, emotion sunk into it. That's called the sunk loss fallacy, actually. And the likelihood of your leaving, of course, if you're only thinking about what you've got sunk into a situation, whether that's 5 years on the job, 15 in a marriage, 20 in a city, that's going to make it difficult for you to move, change, and quit.
And some people, as you say, actually escalate their commitment once they've already sunk in a bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are all sorts of habits of mind that were once, from an evolutionary point of view, you know, really good things. That is escalating your commitment to something if you can't get it. I mean, that almost every love story, you know, the girl, the guy who got away.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the escalation of commitment. But the mind does that, the human mind does that in other ways as well. We tend, for example, to see a loss, and gamblers do this when they play the slots, obviously, but we all do it, seeing a loss as a near win. Now, that's not a bad thing when it comes to physical pursuits, and which is probably why we're hardwired to do it. So if you are, in fact, trying to shoot an animal for food with bow and arrow, and you almost bag the animal, seeing that not as a loss, which spins you off into depression and fear of starvation, but seeing it instead as a near win motivates you to analyze what happened, hone your physical skills just slightly, and by seeing that miss as a near win, it's very likely that you'll gear up in such a way that the next time you'll actually bag the animal. Now, seeing things as a near win instead of a loss is useful in physical pursuits, sports. It's even good when you study, because if you can see that C+ as a near win that almost got you a B, instead of feeling that I failed, this is beyond belief, I got a C, you know, your head.
Right.
The real problem is that skill set, that thinking about things in that way, isn't just limited to studying or physical pursuits. We carry it over into the office, where when the boss doesn't bite our heads off or doesn't dismiss us out of hand, we say, wow, things are really getting better. We're making progress.
I don't have to quit.
And, of course, that happens in a relationship, too,
right,
when,
right.
You know, your partner does something that looks vaguely like what you have been asking him or her to do, and you go, wow, things are really looking up. And that's the near win at work.
And so you feel you don't have to quit, even if you were thinking that.
Well, the point is that all that does is it isn't really progress.
Right. I get you.
So if we're focused on what we have invested, if we're focused on escalating our commitment because we think that if we just give it one more push, we'll get there, or we tend to cast situations not in terms of what they really are, disasters, losses, but near wins, we're going to stay put. And it's simply going to be harder for us to move on, make a change, and set new goals for ourselves and go new places.
Peg Streep is a blogger at psychologytoday.com, author of or co-author of 10 books, including Mean Mothers and Necessary Journeys. We're speaking with her today about mastering the art of quitting, why it matters in life, love, and work, as published by DeCapo. Thank you very much, Peg.
Thank you.
We'll take a break here on Midday again. When we return, we'll finish out the hour with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, author of The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station by Tires Auto, a full-service automobile and truck repair shop in Timonium near the light rail. It is now that time of year for winterizing cars. Loaner cars and gift certificates are available. Tires Auto, 410-252-8001. Support comes from Constellation, providing commercial heating, cooling, and building automation services. Efficiency-made easy upgrades can reduce the energy usage of your business. To learn more, 877-427-2009. License number 01-7302. And support comes from Loyola University Maryland School of Education, celebrating the accomplishments of literacy educators with the 2014 Literacy Leader and Literacy Educator of the Year Awards, Wednesday, February 26th at 6 p.m. at Loyola's Charles Street campus. The event is open to the public. More information is at loyola.edu. The phone number is 410-617-2827. Coming our way later this afternoon.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the story of ballerina Tanakia LeClaire, paralyzed by polio, muse to Balanchine and Jacques d'Amboise.
The tragedy of Tanny is epic. epic. She was destroyed as a dancer.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
You can hear Here and Now this afternoon at 2 here on your public radio, where Midday with Dan Rodericks continues.
And welcome back to Midday. We welcome now psychiatrist Norman Rosenthal to the show. Dr. Rosenthal is a well-known clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown Medical School. He has appeared on radio and television as an expert in seasonal affective disorder. His book, Transcendence, was a New York Times bestseller about transcendental meditation. He joins us this hour to discuss his latest book, The Gift of Adversity, The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections, which is now out in hardback through Penguin Publishing. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome to Midday. It's nice to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Don't they all say that? That's my opening question to you. Don't they all say that adversity builds character, adversity makes me a better person?
Well, you know, I think certainly there have been a lot of people who have said it. Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And Shakespeare said, sweet are the uses of adversity. But most of us, especially when we're in the middle of adversity, the last thing we think of is the gift or the lesson.
And your approach to this was, because you've heard so many stories over the years, and some of these stories involve your own life.
Really, how I got to it was I looked over my life stories and those that I've met along the way, and what I was trying to do was to extract lessons. And then it occurred to me that the best lessons occur when something goes wrong. And then I thought, well, if that's the case, let's kind of wind backwards to the adversity itself when it's actually happening and say, wait a sec, how can I make the most out of this? I never looked for it. I didn't want it. It's awful, but what can I make out of it? That's the sequence that I went through in my own mind.
And in your own life, you hearken to a time in South Africa when you were a surgical intern and you experienced something truly horrific that you think shaped your view of life, immortality, the value of life.
Yes, indeed. I was parking with a girlfriend in a shady lane. And actually, you know, we weren't doing anything in particular. We were chatting, and we were attacked and mugged. I was stabbed. It was horrible. I was nearly killed. She luckily got off without at least the physical wound, but we were both traumatized by it. And when finally I came round, because luckily I got to the hospital in time, and it was a lesson to me in the amazing physiological responses that have obviously been programmed into us over millennia. But it felt like a miracle that I survived. But after that, life actually changed for me. I realized that every day was precious, that nothing should be taken for granted, and it gave me a tremendous force going forward to try and do the best that I could with every day that I had.
Dr. Rosenthal, because we're in the midst of the Winter Olympics, I found it almost irresistible to go to some stories from the Winter Olympics to talk to you about them in the frame of the subject of your book, The Gift of Adversity. So if you don't mind, just take me a moment here to describe a couple of situations from the Olympics that other folks have observed and heard as well. But I'd like to get your thoughts on it. First of all, we had a figure skater, Jeremy Abbott, a U.S. figure skater, who fell down very hard in a program that he was skating in last week. And for a moment, it looked like he wasn't going to get up and finish his program. In fact, he did, and he did it wonderfully and received a great ovation for finishing. After it was over, Jeremy Abbott said, "I'm not in the least bit ashamed. I stood up and I finished that program, and I'm proud of my effort, and I'm proud of what I did under the circumstance." And even though he didn't win and get a medal, of course, people appreciated the fact that he finished. He didn't quit in the midst of that. It would have been understandable because he was in some pain.
You know, when I saw that, and I saw him get up and finish, I mean, my heart soared for him, because I thought to myself, you know, that's life. You fall, you get up, and you do the rest of your job. And that is so remarkably commendable, because when you fall, you know you've lost enough points that you're never going to place anywhere.
Right.
So at one level, you think, why not just walk off the ice? But I think that that really doesn't speak to the human spirit that the Olympics represents. The fact that life is a contest, the fact that these people are in a way we're watching their amazing athleticism and their brilliant accomplishments, but it also really is almost like a metaphor for how all of us are striving for something. And the idea of getting up, dusting yourself off, and finishing your program is just so inspirational, and I think that's why he got the ovation.
There was another story from the Olympics I was eager to ask you about today, and this involved the speed skater, Shani Davis. And last week, there was a controversy among members of the U.S. speed skating team over a racing suit developed by Under Armour, a company that's based here in Baltimore. On Friday, the team, which was not doing very well, hadn't won any medals up to that point, voted to switch to another racing suit, also developed by Under Armour, with which they had had some success in 2013. It didn't seem to make any difference. And the medalist, Davis, who didn't do well on Saturday, even in the new old speed skating suit, seemed to be blaming the suit still for his failures at the Winter Olympics. He said the controversy over the suit and the switching of the suit, the use of a suit that they weren't familiar with, all of that constituted damage, he said. The damage of the suit was already done. And he said that he couldn't face up to the big race on Saturday because of his earlier failing, that not winning a medal in the 1,000 pretty much eliminated him psychologically from winning in the 1,500. It took its toll, he said. I spent energy in ways that I wouldn't have done normally. I did as much as I could to get myself ready, but I felt defeated, meaning before the race on Saturday. Now, given the adversity of this situation, a brief controversy over a speed skating suit, those of us on the outside who are not Olympic athletes look at that and say, Mr. Davis, you're saying that you couldn't possibly win a second race because you lost the first one. It doesn't speak to his resilience. So I'm not sure what the lesson
I think it's true, you know, and I can imagine him being on a chair in my office explaining this to me, and I would understand and I would certainly sympathize because that's how he processed that experience. But certainly our work going forward would be geared towards helping him become more resilient. Now, you know, when we're watching the Olympics and we're expecting heroes, it unfortunately sounds a little bit like whining. And, you know, and we're all allowed to whine. And we all do whine, I'm sure. You have, I have certainly. But it's not good judgment to say that in this particular regard. It's much better to say what the fallen skater said, because the one makes you look like a hero and the other one makes you look like a sore loser. Mm-hmm. So the one hand, it's very human to feel I've lost my mojo because I had a setback. That's a human thing that we then need to try to resolve going forward. But it's not the stuff of which heroism is made, and therefore not good judgment if you're thinking of endorsements and other things going down the line to be saying that on public TV. But if I may just say, the one story that really touched my heart was the Canadian skier. Is his name Bilodeau? Is that his name?
Yes.
The Canadian skier with the cerebral palsy brother.
Yes.
Who has this touching relationship with his brother, where the two brothers absolutely love each other and inspire each other. Tears came to the man's eyes when he talked about how his brother has been his inspiration. I think that's really what gets closest to what I'm talking about, because, you know, the gift of adversity doesn't necessarily show itself right there and then when the adversity occurs. It plays out over time. And here is a family who took the adversity of one of the siblings and really didn't hide him, didn't be ashamed of him, celebrated him as much as they're celebrating his famous athlete brother. And the brother says, you know, heavens knows what he would have become had he had the same opportunities that I had. So there's none of that sort of hubris, but all of the kind of compassion and learning that I think is what I am hoping to have people get out of the book with the gift of adversity.
Now, some people listening to this will probably say, well, how do I prepare myself for adversity? Because so far my life has been pretty good. I've had no experiences like that Dr. Rosenthal described from South Africa, or the situation you just described involving the Canadian and his brother. Because I would, you know, life has gone pretty well for me. I don't think I've faced what true adversity is. So how do I prepare for it?
Well, you know, I think those people will have had a very charmed life, because I've now spoken a lot to live audiences. And say there's 100 people in the audience. I say, which of you has had some major significant adversity in your life? Maybe 85% put their hands up. And I say, and which of you has had some major lesson come out of that adversity? And pretty much the same number puts their hands up. So most people have had adversity, and most people have found that it is one of the biggest lessons of their lives. And there are some people who have charmed lives. And what I would say is I hope it continues until the last day.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's no need to wish adversity on anybody. But should they have adversity, we are programmed to learn from adversity. That's how we've survived all these millions of years. We've been programmed to learn from adversity simply so that we don't do it again.
But Dr. Rosenthal,
yeah.
I need to ask you this, though.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody has their own idea, I guess, such a subjective thing of what adversity is.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's a pretty big word. Adversity is not, you know, you walk out to your car and the tire's flat and you need to be at work in an hour and a half or an hour. I don't consider that adversity. I wonder where our standards for adversity truly are.
You know, you can say that and it's true. But I think it's the little adversities that train you. You know, just like when you're raising a child, you teach them how to endure little frustrations along the way. You're going to have to wait for your dessert. You're going to have to wait your turn before you speak. You're programming into somebody's nervous system frustration tolerance, resiliency. Okay, you didn't plan for the tire to go flat. What are you going to do now? And then when the big adversity comes along, your system's been kind of primed by these little lessons.
Hmm. That's interesting. Do you find patients who come to you because they're dealing with some major adversity in their lives, they would have been among those who held up their hand in the audience for you?
Yes, I say, just not some major adversity.
Yeah.
I deliberately say things like, not like losing your iPhone in the taxi.
Right.
Which is what I just had done before that particular talk, you know. Real adversity, yes. I think, you know, so many of us have lost a loved one, or had a major setback, or had a real serious illness. And, you know, I consider my life a fortunate life, but there are a number of things in the book that really are bad things. And then there are a number of things that are kind of small things, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they are, big or small, the key is let's take something out of them. You know, they happen to us. Let's not whine and complain that the Under Armour wasn't working. Let's just get up, dust ourselves off, finish our program, be thankful that we don't have cerebral palsy like our brother does, but celebrate him every day of our lives. That's the kind of spirit that I'm hoping to cultivate with this book.
So So that, I guess that would be your hope with this book, from your own experiences and those of others, to help people view the obstacles in their own lives a little differently, not as the end of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what about perfectionism? I just wanted to ask you about that before we close up here.
I think perfectionism is very rampant in our culture, and it's not only that we feel the need to be perfect, but we also feel the need to convey an aura of perfection. And I sort of think about the form Christmas letter, which doesn't happen as much these days with email, but it would come and you would hear how Dad's business was thriving and Mom was right there behind him and Johnny was at Harvard and Jackie was at Swarthmore, and they've now thankfully got a big estate so that the Labradors can run around freely in the gardens. And what really may be happening is that Dad's business is on the skids. Mom is just out of rehab. Johnny's walking around stoned. Jackie's holding on to her college by her fingernails because she's having so much stress about everything. So it's just a caricature of the perfectionism that we feel obligated to communicate and the realities, which are just ordinary life. Adversities, good things, bad things. Life is a mixture. Life isn't just one thing. So I think this feeling of needing to be perfect and needing to appear perfect is a tremendous pressure that so many people feel needlessly, because very good and very successful lives can be led far below the line of perfectionism. I don't even know what that word really means.
That's really interesting. I think some people feel a need to be or to feel superior to others. Therefore, they, you know, present themselves as perfect. Oh, there's so much more to talk about here. So, Dr. Rosenthal, I hope you will come to Baltimore someday and visit us.
I would enjoy that. I'm not far away.
I know that. So I would like to invite you to Baltimore to spend an hour with us sometime. I enjoyed this conversation, but maybe we can extend it another day.
My pleasure. Let me know when.
Norman Rosenthal, Dr. Rosenthal's latest book is The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. It's published by Penguin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Luke Spicknell, James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, Maya Brown, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.
Here and Now is next, here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Then stay.